kiosks in cities and parks and even at the Super Bowl. "It sounds like we set this up," I said to Barnaby. "His first plan failed, but then his backup paid off royally. Proof of your eggs in baskets theory." "We didn't set it up, but he did. He doubled his chance of making luck, and it worked," Barnaby said. "He surprised us all along, but it turned out to be a good story, and it even has the advantage of being true," I said with a laugh. At his Princeton Luck Lab, Barnaby had been looking at various scenarios for risk-taking and diversification. He found that for eons, biology has shown the value of diversification, and more recently, successful financial institutions and investors had demonstrated the same. So the question, how many eggs and how many baskets were optimal? He didn't have a single answer because a lot depended on your talents, aspirations, and appetite for risk. But he'd come up with a few general principles. "It usually makes sense to diversify across two or three options," he said. The simplest plan was two similar options, a primary and a fallback, as Alex had done. But you could also throw in a third option that was completely different, in case the first two failed for the same reason. When Alex first left Google, he thought he wanted to travel and have new adventures. "Google is a huge biosphere, but it's still a biosphere with walls and ceilings, and I wanted to see the world and do a lot of things," he told us. So he essentially had that third, very different option. If both of his companies closed, he could pack up and take 6 months to explore New Zealand and Fiji and Bora Bora or wherever he wanted. Options aren't always about having one job or another. They're about seeing that life offers many different opportunities, and luck comes from taking the different paths that will make you happy. Having two options, with a possible outlier third option, seemed like a generally good route to getting lucky. But surely there were exceptions. I started my career as a sports writer and regularly heard coaches thunder about the need to give 110%. If you were coming up to bat in the World Series with the score tied at the bottom of the ninth inning, you weren't going to think about a backup plan. You focused everything you possibly could on that single at-bat. Now Barnaby nodded. "I can think of only two exceptions where it makes sense to put all your eggs in one basket," he said. "The first was where the payoff was so high or the opportunity so narrow that you needed to throw caution to the wind. That would include the ninth inning of the World Series, or, as Barnaby suggested, when you're trying to win an Olympic medal or the love of a special person. The second exception is when that single basket is all that matters for survival," he said. That seemed reasonable. If you want to get lucky making alternate plans for tomorrow, you have to make sure that there will be a tomorrow. After I said goodbye to Barnaby, I walked home thinking about those tomorrows. It occurred to me that when we're in the midst of one adventure, we don't realize how many more are to come. Maybe we can make ourselves lucky by plopping those eggs into our baskets one after another, rather than all at once. A few days later, I got a call from my college friend Jim Bennett. We hadn't seen each other in a long time, but we would always be bonded by wrestling. No, not that kind of wrestling. We were just good friends. But one of my first assignments for the college newspaper was covering the varsity wrestling team, and Jim was one of the stars. It was a fun beat because the wrestlers were smart and determined and incredibly driven, with great biceps, too. It got even better when Jim won the National Collegiate Athletic Association Wrestling Championship, which was an impressively big deal. He was as close to a campus hero as a wrestler can get. On the phone, Jim told me that the NCAA wrestling championships were being held this year at Madison Square Garden, and he had purchased a suite for the 3-day event. Did I want to come by? Some members of the old college team would be there, as well as some of Jim's current colleagues. So on a Thursday evening, I made my way over to Madison Square Garden and found Jim's spacious suite, which had plenty of seats facing the arena, a large, comfy area for chatting, and a big center table filled with enough beer and wine and snacks to make it a good night. Jim looked fit and happy and not too far above the weight class in which he once competed. After college, he had worked for financial firms and then started his own company, Bennett Management. Given the suite, which was usually leased to big corporations, my best guess was that he had achieved the financial equivalent of an NCAA championship. Jim was busy being a gracious host to his many guests, so I started talking with a guy who had been a top executive at Jim's company. He told me that Jim invested in distressed assets and at one point had $2 billion under management. It was a tough, competitive business, and several other similar companies that had started at the same time had since folded. "So what do you think made the difference?" I asked. "How did you guys stay lucky?" "What made us lucky is all this," he said, gesturing toward the arena floor where the college wrestlers were on the mats competing. "Jim was a wrestler, an NCAA champion, and he never gives up. He spent years developing dogged persistence and tenacity. He's the same in business as he was on the mat, patient and purposeful, and he waits for the right opening. Then he has incredible stamina and doesn't mind hurting a little bit. Wrestlers always have something that hurts. But Jim figures out every move and has staying power." "Nice hagiography," I said with a smile. "What's that?" he asked. "A description of a saint." He laughed. "Jim doesn't pay me anymore, so I don't have to say it, but it's all true." Sitting down a few minutes later with a beer for him and a Diet Coke for me, I told Jim what his colleague had said. Jim gave a little smile. "Wrestling does train you to be persistent, and maybe that helps in business," he said. He knows some other wrestlers who had gone on to big success on Wall Street, and the step-by-step approach he took to wrestling had surely helped when he was evaluating companies. "Maybe I was willing to be more methodical and spend more time studying details than most people," he said. At least a third of Jim's competitors went out of business in the 2008 recession, but he didn't panic and got through just fine. "You keep working and looking for opportunities and trying to make your luck," he said. It struck me that Jim was a serial eggs-in-basket guy. He threw himself fully into whatever he was doing, but always had that next egg hatching. He had focused intently and worked endlessly to become an NCAA champion. But he was still at an Ivy League school and studied hard. He did well enough to get into Harvard Business School and set up his next round of luck. Now he brought incredible intensity to his business, but he also took 10 weeks of vacation a year, spending time with his delightfully ebullient wife and their young children. "When you work 70 or 80 hours a week, you can burn out. I want to keep going," he said. Wrestling was still a big part of his life. In fact, he had just been named the team leader for the USA women's team at the 2020 Olympics. But always modest, he didn't want to take too much credit for his long-ago national championship. Understanding my concept that luck was based on talent, hard work, and random chance, he suggested that he'd needed all three. "Everyone who gets to the top level has talent and works hard," he said. "But when you get to those last matches, something can just go your way or not." After a while, Jim got up to return to his hosting duties, and I sidled over to the ringside seats to watch the college wrestlers on the mats below. Jim was probably right that some chance would be involved, as it always is in sports, a bad call, an unexpected injury. But as a general rule, the best wrestlers would win their medals through a combination of talent, hard work, and determination. The winners would be very proud. They deserved to be. They had trained in the gym for hours, run on the streets for miles, and probably eaten celery for days in order to make weight. They'd given all they had to the sport. But I hoped that they also understood that life was long and college wrestling would end, and that, like Jim at the same age, they had another egg hatching in their basket, preparing them for the next stage of life. After I gave Jim a hug goodbye, I left Madison Square Garden, thinking how life is both shorter and longer than you realize. Shorter for all the obvious reasons. Was college that long ago? And longer because you have more cycles and opportunities and chances than you realize when you're starting out. If you want to be lucky, you have to both throw yourself fully into the moment and also be prepared for the future. That takes a couple of eggs and a couple of baskets, and just might be the formula for a lucky life. Chapter 9, The Lucky Break That Really Counts. The big break might start out small. Lay the foundation for luck. Why Alexander Fleming's chance discovery wasn't chance. The lucky breaks that can change the world. As we took a walk together one day through Central Park, Barnaby brought up the subject of lucky breaks, and I began thinking about a lovely young woman who works in the grocery store near my house in rural Connecticut. Always eager to help, she has a gentle style, a warm smile, and an air of competence that her IGA apron can't hide. Plus, she's quite beautiful, with the slightly exotic looks of the first assistant I hired when I was a TV producer. But there she was in rural Connecticut, packing groceries. I imagined that she came from a family without a lot of advantages. And how would she ever get a chance to be lucky? "I wish I could be her fairy godmother and bring her to New York and get her a job in television," I said. "Could you imagine what she'd do with a break like that?" "It might be amazing, or it might lead to disaster," Barnaby said. "Not everybody knows how to handle a lucky break when it comes along." "Really? A lucky break that doesn't make you lucky?" In the best of all worlds, a lucky break is the monumental event that changes everything. Your boss quits and hands you his job, your startup sells for $1 billion, or your YouTube video goes viral and makes you famous. Actress Shirley MacLaine was just out of high school and an understudy for the Broadway production of The Pajama Game when the starring actress broke her ankle and MacLaine landed center stage. A very literal lucky break, though only for one of them. Those earth-shattering events do happen, but Barnaby was right. Like MacLaine, your lucky break could lead to a career marked by 6 Academy Award nominations, or it could lead to absolutely nothing. Because if you're not prepared, you're going to blow the chance you've been given. The real secret is knowing what to do after the big opportunity comes, because a lucky break is not the same as a lucky outcome. In our slot machine of chance, talent, and hard work, a lucky break is the big cherry of chance. But you still need those other 2 cherries lined up. We've all heard the stories of athletes with multi-million-dollar contracts who get arrested and thrown out of their sport, or lottery winners who end up penniless and angry. A lucky break turns out to be like any other opportunity. You can recognize that it's in front of you and make it part of a lucky life, or you can mishandle it so it leads to nothing or disaster. You'll be able to make the most of a lucky break only if you've laid the proper foundation for it. MacLaine didn't just waltz or tap dance onto the Broadway stage. She had been preparing to be a dancer since she was 3 years old. Acting was also in the family genes. Her brother is actor Warren Beatty. When she had the chance to be on stage, she was fully prepared. Similarly, if you buy a lottery ticket with an actual idea of what you'll do with the winnings, you'll be in a better position to handle the windfall than if you've just fantasized that big bucks will change your life. The chances of winning are so small that preparing ahead probably isn't worth it in this case, but you get the point. Many times a lucky break isn't a huge rupture in the earth, but just the tiniest little crack. A small advantage can grow into something big and bigger. If you're waiting for the big break, you'll miss the truth that most luck builds and builds on itself. The challenge is to realize how a tiny lucky break can become an enormous one. As an example, Barnaby suggested that he would like to give me a lucky break in the form of a penny that doubled every day. He would give me the value at the end of a week. How was that for generous? I looked up at him, he's tall, and turned up my nose. "Wouldn't you?" It doesn't take a lot of math skills to figure out the magic penny will be worth only 64 cents at the end of the week. "Okay, I can do better than that," Barnaby said. Could he lure me with the penny if it kept doubling until the end of the month? Was that good enough for a lucky break? Now I sighed. "Really, Barnaby, you're supposed to be offering a lucky break and instead you're playing with pennies." He could feel my pain, so now he gave me a choice. At the end of the month, I could have the value of that doubling penny or $1 million. Which would I like? $1 million? There must be a catch, but I still couldn't resist. I told Barnaby I'd take the million. Barnaby looked a little smug. "Wrong choice," he said. "The doubling penny will be worth more than $1 million at the end of the month." "It can't be. Trust me on this." I didn't trust him because it just didn't make sense. How could a penny be the right choice? He sat down on a bench and quickly wrote out the numbers to prove it. $1 million was fine with me, and I hadn't done badly in taking it. But the real opportunity came with the doubling penny, which I, and probably you, passed right by. Hard as it is to believe, that penny would be worth $10.7 million at the end of the month. So I could have been 10 times luckier if I had realized the power of cumulative advantage. As he said, small bits of luck can turn into big ones. By the way, Barnaby quickly clarified that all this was theoretical. He wished he could give me that doubling penny. Instead of waiting for the magical million that will change everything, you would be better to start thinking about and collecting the pennies that will build and make you a real or proverbial fortune. Luck builds on luck. The biggest lucky break of all could start out as nothing more than a copper coin. Lucky people set themselves up for the big break by taking those dancing lessons, or getting the penny, or simply being open to possibilities in different ways than others. We're all suckers for stories about the big life-changing or world-changing moments of luck. Everybody has probably heard by now that penicillin, post-it notes, and Velcro were discovered by accident. Supposed lucky breaks like those take on almost mythic proportions. But you have to be careful about giving too much credence to the serendipitous lucky break that led to the discovery or invention, because that undermines the truer story of the determined efforts before and after that really create luck. So let's start with the story that penicillin was discovered by sheer chance when Alexander Fleming found mold growing in one of his petri dishes. As the story goes, he went away for a month-long family vacation in September 1928 and left several petri dishes with Staphylococcus bacteria on the windowsill of his lab. When he got back, one of the dishes was contaminated with mold. And lo and behold, the bacteria surrounding the mold had been destroyed. He didn't shout Eureka or go running naked through the streets, as Archimedes reportedly once did, but he did realize that the mold might have inhibited the bacterial growth. And there you have it. One lucky break and millions of people have been saved from diseases like strep throat and scarlet fever, as well as wound infections. When I woke up just after dawn on September 28, 1928, I certainly didn't plan to revolutionize all medicine by discovering the world's first antibiotic or bacteria killer. But I suppose that was exactly what I did, Fleming said later. The revolution wasn't quite as casual as all that. During World War I, Fleming had been in the Royal Army Medical Corps, doing research into wound infections and antiseptics. After the war, he returned to his lab at St. Mary's Hospital at the University of London, and by 1921, he had made his first big discovery, finding an enzyme that fights bacteria. That research reportedly began when Fleming had a cold and dropped some mucus into one of his bacteria cultures. Are you starting to see a pattern here? The dropped mucus and the plopped mold were serendipitous, but they were common events. It wasn't their occurrence that was so lucky and magical, but what Fleming made of them. At the time of his family vacation, Fleming had been working on questions about bacteria and the human immune system for more than a decade. As is often the case in science, he had many small breakthroughs and lots of incremental steps. Many of the things he tried didn't lead anywhere. When one does pay off, it's not random luck. It's the result of months and years of focused energy and plenty of experiments that didn't pan out. You get lucky only when you know what you're looking for. Someone else coming into Fleming's lab after that vacation might have tossed away the contaminated petri dish without a second thought. One man's scientific breakthrough is another man's yucky, moldy mess. And despite the lucky break, Fleming didn't revolutionize medicine on September 28th. The real challenge came afterward, as it so often does. He added two researchers to his team, but he wasn't successful in isolating and purifying the mold juice. Not long after, two scientists at the University of Oxford, Howard Florey and Ernst Chain, led a team that finally created the first usable doses of penicillin. They ultimately shared a Nobel Prize with Fleming. Flory and Shane never got much media attention because all they offered was the moral that intelligence and hard work pay off. Fleming's story had magic and mystery. The distracted scientist, the messy lab, the mold plopping into a dish placed on a windowsill. Luck, serendipity, and the world has changed. But the lucky break was only one step in the chain. Much had to occur ahead of time for it to mean anything, and even more had to happen afterward for it to pay off. The lucky breaks we remember are the ones that pay off. If Fleming's colleagues hadn't ultimately made penicillin, we wouldn't be telling the story of the moldy petri dish. Lots of understudies step into the starring role, but since they don't become Shirley MacLaine, or her equivalent, we don't have any reason to remember them. The lessons of the past are helpful only if we can use them to recognize the lucky break when it happens to us. Josh Groban is now one of the biggest pop stars in the country, but when he was 18 years old, his future wasn't that obvious. I was happily invited to a small dinner with him recently and was struck by how smart, thoughtful, and serious he seemed. Really, shouldn't a pop star be a little more vacuous? He told me that shortly after he started as a freshman in the prestigious theater program at Carnegie Mellon, he was offered a recording contract from Warner Brothers Records. He remembered sitting on the bed in his college dorm, wondering what to do. Was this the lucky break that would shoot him to stardom? Or if he blew off school, would he end up coming back a semester later, tail between his legs? I expected I'd be a failure and come back, but if I didn't do it, I imagined how much I'd resent being in dance classes the next semester, he said. Recording contracts don't come out of the blue. For Groban, luck led to luck when he stood in for the famed Italian tenor Andrea Bocelli at a rehearsal for the 1999 Grammy Awards. Singing a duet with Celine Dion, he immediately impressed Grammy host Rosie O'Donnell, who had a TV talk show at the time. She invited Groban to come on the next week and sing, and the appearance led hotshot producer David E. Kelly to write a role for Groban on the then hugely popular TV show Ally McBeal. So was the lucky break filling in for Bocelli, appearing with O'Donnell, impressing Kelly, or getting the recording contract? Like our doubling penny, it all compounded. But then Groban had to take all these breaks and make them into something beyond one-time opportunities. He took the risk to leave school and performed with big stars all over the country. His eponymous debut album in 2001 quickly went from gold to double platinum. A few years and several records later, he had 4 multi-platinum records and was the best-selling artist in the country. Even as a big star, Josh continued to make his own luck. Though he hadn't done musical theater since he was a teenager, I was sailor number 4 in Anything Goes, he joked, our dinner was to celebrate the announcement of his Broadway debut in an offbeat show called Natasha, Pierre, and the Great Comet of 1812. I wanted to do something new that scared me, Josh said. He was learning to play the accordion for the part and expected to wear a heavily padded suit to look more like the stout and dissolute Pierre. The show had been conceived by a cool downtown writer named Dave Malloy and directed by the equally cool Rachel Chavkin. Both had high cred as unconventional artists who didn't care about popular audiences. Knowing that Rachel and Dave traveled in a crowd of experimental artists, Josh admitted that he was half dreading and half amused at the thought of the downtown crowd coming to see him, one of America's biggest pop stars, on Broadway. I want all Dave's and Rachel's friends to leave the show thinking, I really liked Josh and I'm ashamed of myself, he said with a laugh. When the show opened, it was pretty clear that everybody, even the cool friends, really liked Josh. The reviewer for the New York Times called him absolutely wonderful and said he went to see the show twice in 2 days. Groban got a Tony nomination. Benefiting from a lucky break is easier when you have the talent and drive of Josh Groban. But whatever your situation, you need to recognize that an opportunity could be in front of you and take the risk to get up from your college dorm bed and pursue it. A lucky break becomes meaningful only if it falls on fertile ground. Barnaby and I both have many talents, we hope you agree, But singing is not among them. If I had the chance to perform at a Grammy rehearsal, the result would not be Groban-like pop stardom, but rather many people wearing earplugs. For a lucky break to have an impact, you need to be ready for it, like Alexander Fleming, and able to make use of it, like Josh Groban. Giving someone a lucky break that pays off isn't as easy as it might sound. Back in 1981, the philanthropist Eugene Lang was speaking to a group of sixth graders at the school in East Harlem that he had attended 50 years earlier. As he looked out at the 61 children from low-income families, the idea struck him of offering them a collective lucky break. He made an impromptu offer. He would pay the college tuition of everyone who graduated from high school. The kindly fairy godfather sprinkling lucky dust on a school of children made headlines around the country. In interviews, Lang pointed out that it wasn't just the money that made the difference, but the ability of the children to dream. Somebody cared about them. He quickly realized that the big break he was offering, free tuition, wouldn't do anything if the kids didn't have the grit or interest or vision to stay in school. So he put people in place who could tutor and help support the kids and their struggling parents. And the result? The ground wasn't as fertile as it needed to be. One boy robbed a grocery store and went to prison, and several girls got pregnant. Others dropped out of school. But about half of the original 61 students took advantage of the lucky break and went on to college, some to schools as prestigious as Swarthmore and Barnard. That doesn't sound like a lot until you hear that before Lang's offer, the principal had estimated that only one kid from the class would ever make it to college. Lang's program spread, and his I Have a Dream Foundation inspired programs all over the country. Other philanthropists followed Lang's lead, adopting inner-city classes and offering college tuition to kids who made it through high school. The appeal is obvious. Those who have been successful in their own lives can often look back and recognize the people along the way who helped and supported them, parents or a teacher or the first guy who gave them a job. They feel fortunate. The idea of giving a lucky break to kids who wouldn't otherwise have one is compelling. These luck interventions have gotten more formalized since Lang's spontaneous offer, but the results are often similar. Graduation rates do go up, and some kids who would never have had a chance to shine take advantage of their lucky break. But not everyone. When one generous donor tried to give the lucky break to 112 students in a blighted community in West Philadelphia, he ended up with more felons than college graduates. Only one student had a smooth passage through college. He is now an aeronautical engineer. Two wealthy men, Abe Polin and Melvin Cohen, got on the lucky break bandwagon when they set up a Dreamers program at one of the poorest schools in Prince George's County, Maryland, in 1988. Polin was well known at the time as the owner of several big sports teams, including the Washington Capitals in the National Hockey League and the Washington Bullets of the National Basketball Association. He regularly wore a big smile and a big gold NBA championship ring. The two men did everything right. They put a mentor in place to help the kids and parents and promised to pay full in-state tuition at the University of Maryland for everyone. They brought the kids to the Capitol Center to watch the Bullets games and got to know them all. The effort got a lot of media attention, and as the kids appeared on the local news, they understood how lucky they were. Just for being in the right fifth grade class, they had opportunities for the future, the ultimate lucky break. But once again, despite a huge effort and big bucks, the results were equivocal. As the Washington Post reported in a follow-up of the 59 students more than 20 years later, one student became a doctor and another a cellist. But the successes were mixed in with disasters. One would kill herself. One would kill his father. One would become a politician. One would become a cop. One would become a drug dealer. The mixed results suggest that the upshot of a lucky break can range from heartwarming to heartbreaking. The kids in East Harlem and West Philadelphia and Prince George's County had many obstacles, making it tough for them to take advantage of the opportunity. Sharon Darling, who founded the National Center for Families Learning back in 1989, advised Lange at one point on how to get families involved. Part of the problem, as she saw it, was that the college tuition didn't feel like a lucky break to everyone. The parents didn't go to college themselves, and they expected their kids to get a job after high school and earn some money. They certainly didn't want them to move away, she told me. If you're a teenager, it's hard to take advantage of a lucky break if your parents are seeing it as an obstacle. And it's even harder to see advantages that will accrue in the long term if you're suffering in the short term. Many of us don't have those same overwhelming barriers, but we put others in our way. We don't see the opportunity or simply don't realize that it could be life-changing. We're so used to our usual patterns that we're reluctant to take a risk and veer in a new direction. So, for example, if someone offered you the chance to travel 6,000 miles away for a new job, would you consider it a ridiculous idea or a lucky break? A man I recently met named Gustavo Rimberg faced that question some years ago when he was in his late 20s and living in Buenos Aires. He and his lovely wife Marissa had both grown up in Argentina and had no thought of leaving. But then representatives of the Jewish community from the city of Winnipeg in Manitoba, Canada, arrived with an offer. Wanting to bring new young energy to their community, they were encouraging Jewish families from South America to immigrate by offering help with jobs, housing, and schooling. Winnipeg, they promised, would be a supportive and warm community. Warm in spirit, anyway. Temperatures can drop to minus 40 degrees on Winnipeg's windswept prairie, and the average temperature in January is about 2 degrees. Snowdrifts outnumber people, and they're usually taller, too. By any estimation, Winnipeg is in the middle of nowhere. The closest big city is Minneapolis, more than 400 miles south. And when you have to go south to get to Minneapolis, you know you're in cold climes. But Gustavo was intrigued. He had grown up at the time of the military junta in Argentina when thousands of people were disappeared. Democracy had been restored, but the economy was shaky, the peso continued to be devalued, and there was a bombing at the embassy of Israel. Gustavo wasn't convinced that Buenos Aires was the best place to raise a Jewish family. Our daughters were 4 years old and 10 months at the time, so maybe it was crazy, he told me over a hearty Canadian breakfast of eggs and home fries. I tried to think about possibilities not just at the moment, but into the future. He envisioned what the opportunities would be for his children in both places, and within a month, he and Marissa packed up their house, their two children, and their high expectations. They got on a plane, ready to take advantage of the lucky break that had been offered in Winnipeg. But believe me, it didn't feel like a lucky break at first, he said with a laugh and a charming accent. There was a 70-degree drop in temperature from when we left Buenos Aires to when we arrived in Winnipeg. That first winter, all of us were sick. But the community was as welcoming as promised, and Gustavo and Marissa quickly found jobs and a sense of belonging. We were the first family to arrive under the immigration program, so we were practically local celebrities, he said. Everybody wanted us to be happy. They were happy. In that supportive community, their opportunities expanded and their luck seemed to multiply. One job led to another, and they stayed for 9 years, eventually moving to Toronto, where the winters are slightly better. Gustavo says that moving to Winnipeg didn't necessarily look like a lucky break to his friends. Trade long sunny days at the beach for short dark ones on the prairie? No, thank you. They couldn't understand what I was thinking, he said. But now those same friends from Buenos Aires come often to visit, and they see we have this nice house and nice life and I have this good job, and they say, "Oh, you're so lucky." They don't know how hard that first year was, or how many nights we lay in bed crying because we missed our families. So I say, lucky? No. It's what you choose to make happen for yourself. It's what you do now because of where it can lead in the future. In retrospect, the lucky break may look like sun-kissed or snow-kissed serendipity. You happened to be one of the kids in the class that a rich guy decided to support. Or you were in the right place when a Jewish community was looking to expand. But in order for that chance event to pay off, additional elements from our luck equation of talent and hard work must come into play. Gustavo and Marissa got to watch their daughters grow up in a nurturing environment and attend good colleges. Maybe it was difficult to move with babies, but new research suggests that that was exactly the right time to give them the lucky break. Raj Chetty, now a professor of economics at Stanford, should know something about early starts. He got his PhD from Harvard at age 23 and was one of the school's youngest tenured professors. He has found that the greatest gains for upward mobility and other advancements come for children who move to better environments when they're very young. Chetty recently looked at the data from a 1990s Clinton administration project called Moving to Opportunity, which helped some families move from the poorest housing projects to more economically mixed areas. Researchers who first followed the results were disappointed. They had expected that the people who moved would get better jobs and family outcomes, but that didn't seem to happen. Chetty decided to look at the results from a different perspective. Many of the families had small children when they moved. Did the lucky break change their lives? Some 20 years later, Chetty discovered that the results were actually quite remarkable for the kids who moved when they were under 5. You see extremely clearly that they are doing dramatically better today as adults, he said. The lucky move meant that their incomes were significantly higher. They were more likely to go to college and less likely to be single parents than children who stayed in the projects or who moved later in their lives. Using lucky breaks to create social change can work, but with caveats. As with the housing moves, the lucky break has to be given at the right time in a child's life. And as with the college tuition programs, it won't work for everyone. The people who receive the lucky break still have to recognize that they've been handed an opportunity and act on it. Getting a lucky break is always the start of the story, not the end of it. The 20 or so men and women who receive the Genius Awards every year from the MacArthur Foundation aren't required to act on their lucky break, since each one gets $625,000 over 5 years with no strings attached. The winners have already proven that they have talent and a willingness to work hard, two strands of the luck equation. But when given the final strand of chance, in the form of the unexpected fellowship, they recognize the lucky opportunity and want to take advantage of it, even if nobody is checking up on them. When I called Cecilia Conrad, the MacArthur Foundation Managing Director who oversees the awards, officially called a MacArthur Fellowship, she immediately concurred. The no-strings aspect seems to convey its own kind of responsibility, she said with a laugh. The Genius Grant can feel like luck at its most magical. It's all handled through a confidential nominating and evaluation process, so nobody knows they're being considered. And even if you have a suspicion that you're in the running, you can't sit around waiting for the news because there's no fixed date for the announcement. So when the winners get the call from Conrad announcing their award, they're usually flustered and flummoxed. It feels like a bolt from the blue, the ultimate lucky break. Once they're over the initial excitement, the fellows use their lucky break to run in many directions. Conrad said that for many, it gives renewed push and commitment to their path. Others see it as a safety net to take new risks. Some see it as a chance to become more public scholars or intellectuals. The fellowships are meant to celebrate creativity in every field imaginable. Yes, poets and playwrights win, but MacArthur has also recognized blacksmithing and bow making for stringed instruments, not arrows. Anne Basting, who got her fellowship in 2016, uses theater and storytelling to improve the lives of people with dementia. When people at cocktail parties ask what I do, I never knew what to say, and my husband would step in with something pithy, Basting told me when we spoke by phone one morning. I always tried to legitimize my work, but I don't have to do that anymore. It's a relief and a savings of energy. Basting heard the news about her Genius Award, the luckiest break she could imagine, one day when she was driving in her car and the phone rang. She didn't recognize the number, but picked up anyway. Conrad, who has a very cheerful voice, introduced herself, and asked Basting if she were in a place to have a private conversation. Hearing that she was in the car, Conrad suggested she pull over. But I told her that I was in a construction zone with no place to pull over, so we'd have to chat for a mile until the next exit, Basting said with a laugh. Did she realize then what was coming? You never want to open yourself to disappointment, so I thought maybe she wanted me to give a reference for someone else. Ultimately, it was wise that she finally pulled over, since when she heard the news, she burst into tears. Basting was the first person from the University of Wisconsin at Milwaukee ever to win a Genius Award, and only a handful of the winners, close to 1,000 since the awards began in 1981, have ever hailed from that state at all. The foundation created a map showing where all the MacArthur Fellows were born and where they lived when they won the award. And aside from the international winners, New York and California come out on top in both counts. When you adjust for population, the prominence of winners born in those states isn't surprising, but much more dramatic is where people ended up. Well over half were living in New York, California, and Massachusetts when they got the Lucky Fellowship. If you want to increase your luck in any creative field, from arts to science to humanities to teaching, you may need to buy a plane ticket. There's an element of putting yourself in places where luck might find you, Conrad said. The complementarities for people in the same place make more opportunities for luck to happen. Big cities draw more creative and original types, and there are also clusters around top educational institutions. Lucky breaks and $625,000 don't just fall from the sky, and Conrad thinks you pave the way for your own good fortune. It starts with basic competency, skills, and hard work, and being passionate about possibilities, she said. Then comes a willingness to pursue your passions without an obvious end in sight. The payoff may be far off and outside the norm. You have to take risks and be willing to fail, which is a form of resilience, she added. Anne Basting is a perfect example of all that. She got lucky by caring only about the deep impact her work would have. I don't follow the same benchmarks for success that other people do, she admitted. My satisfaction for the work is what keeps me persevering. I count the importance of my work by how it makes me feel, and I know that when others see it, they feel the power of it too. A willingness to find your own niche and dance on the creative edges, no matter what the result, brings its own good luck. You become the only judge of what matters, and with or without a fellowship, the work feels like a lucky break. Speaking with Cecilia Conrad and Anne Basting, I realized that there's another sort of follow-through at play here. A lucky break can have a huge multiplier effect. When you change one person's life, you can have a domino effect on others. Anne Basting works with people with dementia. Please don't call them patients, she said. And her lucky break with the Genius Award means she can spread the wealth and the opportunities to more of the elderly who need it. The MacArthur Foundation is now trying to support that domino effect by getting into the lucky break business in the biggest way possible, offering a $100 million grant to a single project. $100 million. That's big bucks no matter how you look at it. Conrad told me that the foundation's 100 and change competition gave a payout 10 or 100 times bigger than the biggest grants that foundations typically give. And it came with almost no guidelines. The idea wasn't just to figure out the solution to a problem, but to decide what problem needed to be solved. I always said I have the coolest job when I was working just with the fellows. Now I have the double coolest job because I'm doing this too, said Conrad. Conrad had expected a lot of proposals, but she and her colleagues were taken aback when more than 1,900 proposals came in. But there was a lesson for the rest of us in that too. A majority of the proposals were dropped for not meeting basic requirements, and only 800 were passed on to the judges. If you want a lucky break on a massive scale, you have to be prepared. You have to put in the time and effort and not expect miracles. The 8 proposals selected as semifinalists ranged from a plan to cure river blindness in Nigeria to a new concept from Sesame Street to educate displaced children in countries like Syria. The real lucky break from all this wasn't just to the winner of the contest. It was to the millions of people who would be the beneficiaries of the project. So can giving a lucky break change lives on a grand scale, creating a domino effect in the best possible way? We hope so, said Conrad. And it's inspiring, isn't it? Yes, I was inspired, but I still couldn't help thinking about the young woman packing groceries in Connecticut. She could try to set herself up for a lucky break by working hard, taking some risks, and being willing to try an original path. And if she did get a break, of any kind, she needed to be willing to recognize it and have the courage to move forward. The next time I went to the grocery store, I thought I would talk to her and find out a little more about who she was and what her future might hold. But she wasn't there. When I didn't see her the next time either, I asked the store manager if she had left. She sure did. She got a college scholarship. Not a huge one, but enough for her to get started, he said with a bit of paternal pride. I smiled and walked away. It struck me that the college scholarship was like the lucky penny, the perfect start for luck. If the young woman from the grocery store saw the possibilities and kept multiplying the opportunities, she could turn the small break into a huge windfall. I thought of the great Russian writer Boris Pasternak, who said that when a great moment knocks on the door of your life, it is often no louder than the beating of your heart, and it is very easy to miss it. You have to know when your lucky break has knocked, in any size or form. You don't want to miss it, and you need to be ready to make it grow. Part 3. Targeted luck. Look on every exit as being an entrance somewhere else. Tom Stoppard, Rosencrantz, and Guildenstern are dead. If opportunity doesn't knock, build a door. Milton Berle. Chapter 10. How to get a job at Goldman Sachs, or anywhere you want. Don't follow the usual routes. Listen to your hairdresser. Have the courage to recognize an opportunity. Drop out of Harvard if you want to. Barnaby regularly insisted that our principles of luck had to be robust, a word that always made me think of a chubby, red-cheeked toddler. But in science lingo, it means the rules can hold up in most circumstances. The term is adapted from computer programmers, who use it to ensure that their coding will work even if there are errors during input. And you probably don't want to get too deeply into this lingo, because then you find out about fuzz testing, which involves putting in random data and seeing if it crashes the whole program. We were pretty sure that our program for making luck wasn't fuzzy at all, and the principles, from being attentive to zigging when others zagged, were definitely robust. They could get you through anything. But now that we had figured out the big theories, I wondered how they would work in everyday situations. Making yourself lucky in a theoretical sense is nice, but it's a lot better if you can get lucky in the areas that really count, like love, work, and family. We decided to start with work. What was the best way to get to that intersection of chance, talent, and hard work that would make you lucky in your career? Barnaby told me a funny story about the go-getters who apply to be first-year analysts at Goldman Sachs. Most are at the top of their game and the top of their class, at an Ivy League school, preferably. And with so many high-level people competing, any little edge can make a difference. So they write carefully crafted cover letters, deliberate about whether their resume should be in Helvetica or Arial font, and look for the bon mot that will make them stand out. One year, the Goldman Sachs managing director, who was overseeing recruiting, piled all the resumes of potential analysts on his desk, then divided them into two smaller stacks. He deliberated for a moment, and then tossed one of the stacks into the wastebasket. When his colleagues looked at him in surprise, he gave a little shrug. "You have to be lucky in this business," he said. Then, pointing to the resumes still on his desk, he added, "We might as well pick from the lucky ones." I laughed. It was a great story, and a pleasure to think of the most elite guys around being subject to the laws of randomness. I asked Barnaby if this tale was really true or just Wall Street legend. I haven't been able to pin down the source, he admitted, but nobody I've ever met in business doubts that it's true. If you have ever applied for a job or spent time trying to build a career, you know that randomness seems to determine outcomes more than seems fair. Your future and fate may depend on whether the human resources person has a headache the morning she meets you, or whether the executive who interviews you played squash at the same college you did. A whimsical executive tossing out resumes just to make a point seems like it's all part of the game. The story got us thinking. If you're trying to make your own luck, as we've been describing all along, how can you possibly make sure that your resume ends up in the pile that stays on the desk? Once we'd posed the question to ourselves, we spent some time batting it around. Had we finally hit on an example where the randomness, which you can't control, was the operating force in luck, well beyond the other elements that you can control, like talent and hard work? Unless you have magical powers, you can't move your resume to the pile that stays on the desk, I said worriedly. Right, Barnaby agreed. But he looked perturbed for only a moment or so, before immediately brightening up. So you don't want to be in one of those piles at all? Aha. The managing director at Goldman Sachs was right that you're going to need luck to get a job. But remember that the luck we've been describing comes at the intersection of chance, talent, and hard work. The whimsical decision to toss away half the resumes is a perfect example of random chance. If you're in the wrong pile, there's nothing you can do. And while you can't remove random chance from life, unless you do have those magical powers, you have to be prepared to work around it. You can't always anticipate the unexpected, but you can focus on elements that are in your control, and thus make chance less chancy. So let's say you're applying for that job at Goldman Sachs. The trick is to make sure that your resume ends up in a third stack, a small selection that the managing director has already pulled and knows he'll look at and consider. Now, it may seem like we're working backward here, because when you're applying, you can't possibly know that the managing director is going to do something so random. But whether you're in the year of the lucky versus unlucky resume piles or not, it's a good bet that a basic resume, even one set in Helvetica font and accompanied by a brilliant cover letter, won't be enough to get you hired. Standard techniques rarely work in a hyper-competitive environment. You need something that will make you stand out from the beginning, so that your resume isn't in either of the stacks on his desk. One approach is to imagine the person who would definitely be lucky in this situation. You can, for example, figure that if some top-level executive had a child applying for the Goldman Sachs job, he'd call the CEO directly and make sure that his prodigy's resume was at least seen. Instead of stomping around and complaining about how unfair it all is, you can figure out how that example applies to you. Assuming your family ties lean more toward plumbers and accountants and sales reps than investment bankers, what's the best next step? Clearly, you need to find somebody else who can pick up the phone and make that call for you. And that's not as hard as it sounds. Don't worry about what your mom and dad can or can't do for you. Remember that sociologists have shown that luck doesn't always or even usually come from the people closest to you. You need to rely on the strength of weak ties. Barnaby had come across an executive coach named Don Asher, who has written a dozen books on how to get a job. So we tracked him down to get his advice on the topic. He said that you're most likely to find the person who can make that call if you cross the boundaries of the bubble where you normally live. You miss a lot of luck if you interact only with your own friends. Asher told us about one client who was in retail sales and wanted to break into the fashion business. He told her to ask everyone she encountered if they knew anyone in the field. She was in the gym with her personal trainer, Helga, and told her the situation, and it turned out that one of Helga's clients was the vice president of finance for a major designer, said Asher. Connection made. We called two other career coaches, and it turned out that the Helga story wasn't an anomaly. people such as hairdressers and personal trainers, whose professions naturally let them cross boundaries, are unexpectedly good sources for luck. Know specifically what you're asking for, and you can trigger a lucky connection while you're taking a hip-hop dance class or getting a layered bob with blonde highlights. One of the strongest of the weak ties often turns out to be college alumni connections. It's hard to say exactly why the fact that you attended Notre Dame rather than Penn State should make someone want to talk with you, but it works. Psychologists have shown over and over that people form tribal allegiances over often insignificant ties. Give half a group red t-shirts and the other half blue ones, and all of a sudden people are fiercely loyal to their color mates. They'll be more likely to lend them money and cooperate with them in games. Our neurologically wired instinct for group identification has led to tragic events throughout history, from religious wars to genocides to immigration bans. Turning that instinct on its head and using group identification for positive purposes seems like the very least we can do to start balancing the scale. So if you're applying for that job at Goldman Sachs or elsewhere, check out LinkedIn or your college alumni directory, and find someone at a high level at the company who attended your college. Or you can try something even more creative. I happened to meet a young guy named Tyler, who told me that he spent much of his senior year in college trying to find a job through the usual channels. He applied to companies that did on-campus recruiting and put his resume into the school's career directory. "Nothing lucky broke my way," he said. "I was at a small Division III school, and the firms I was interested in didn't even come here." Tyler thinks of school in terms of NCAA divisions because he happens to be a talented lacrosse player. Toward the end of his final season, he went to his coach and asked if he could get a list of lacrosse alumni and their current contacts. The coach had it easily available since he often invited alums to celebrate at post-game parties and maybe make a donation. Tyler noticed one guy on the list who had worn the same number he did and had even played the same midfield position 20 years earlier. He now ran an insurance business in Atlanta. I sent him a picture of myself in uniform with the number clearly visible and told him that I'd be very interested in his company, Tyler said. I wrote, "As you know, midfielders are the backbone of any team." A couple of days later, he got a call from the alum. "I checked with the coach, and he said you've got speed, stamina, and hustle," the alum said. "And determination," Tyler added. "Lots of determination, obviously," the alum said with a laugh. After two trips to Atlanta and a winning lacrosse season, Tyler had a job. I think my parents were embarrassed that I got the job through lacrosse connections, like they'd spent all this money for college and the only thing that paid off was my stick handling. "But I figure whatever makes you lucky is okay," he said. In this case, I have to agree with Tyler rather than his parents. He knew the kind of job he wanted, and when luck didn't naturally come his way, he made the luck for himself. The fact that Tyler and the alum played the same position and wore the same number was definitely a bit of random chance. But Tyler then had to capture the luck by being skillful enough to recognize the opportunity and find a creative way to pursue it. Chance, talent, and effort, and bingo, you seem lucky. I wondered if I could be exaggerating the need for connections to keep you from the tossed resume pile until I talked to Jack, a 31-year-old executive at a quickly expanding e-commerce site. Smart and hardworking, Jack is exactly the kind of inspired and thoughtful manager most people would like as a boss. He's figured out that supporting the people on his team works out for everyone. Jack needed to hire some 20 people when he started out, and the human resources group flooded him with hundreds of elegant resumes and properly written cover letters from applicants who boasted of impressive colleges and business schools and wide-ranging experience. How do you make the distinctions? Most of the people I hired had made some effort to reach out to me directly, or they tracked down someone in the company who could put in a good word, Jack said. He wanted people who were self-starting and could take charge, and making the effort to connect with him was one way to prove their skill. Networking or weak ties gave them an edge. I hadn't really planned it that way, but when someone shows they're eager and goes that extra step, you notice them, Jack said. The new online company was acquired by a bigger firm, and Jack and everyone he hired seemed very lucky on their stock.